Welcome to After Hours with me, Rick Kogan. Sorry, I was off last week. I don't even remember why. It wasn't me. I don't think it was me. I have been in love with the writing of Libby Fisher-Hellman for roughly, I don't know, probably 20 years. Her latest book is another winner. I'm going to read you the opening paragraph, and then I'm going to talk to Libby for a half hour about her life and career before we get back to this fabulous book. It begins, Max Steiner wanted to kill Nazis. He had reasons. The Nazis had killed the people he loved. They'd forced him to flee Germany, then, a few years later, Holland as well. Hitler had stolen his life. He was not, and would never be, like other 22-year-old men. That'll grab you. That will grab you. Libby, hi.
Hey, Rick. How are you?
I'm good. How are you? It's been... When did you write your first novel? 20 years ago?
I started writing in 1996, wow. But I wasn't published until 2000.
That's the way it often goes. Libby, let's talk about, I'm going to talk about your life and career before we get to this fabulous book. I do know this. I didn't do a lot of research because I want to learn and get the joy of learning. You were born in Washington, went to the University of Pennsylvania. Then you went to NYU, New York University, to study, to get an MFA in film and TV. What kind of childhood did you have and young adulthood that drew you to that wicked world of film and TV?
Edward R. Murrow.
Really?
Yeah, he was making documentaries, and they were about real issues. And as I was a girl, you know, becoming a teenager and wanted to focus on issues of the world, you know, because I was going to change the world, of course, I thought that I needed to do what he was doing. And so that's when I started to get interested. And I worked at a radio station while I was in college at WXPN was a college radio station. But then KYW, I was a copy girl there. And then when I came back to D.C., I worked at WRC in their documentary unit for local documentaries. And so by the time I finished college, I knew that I needed to learn how to film. I needed to learn how it worked so I could make documentaries.
I went
to NYU, which was wonderful.
Sure.
And it seduced me into the world of feature films and subsequently books.
Wow. Even at that time, and I think even now, that world of the media film world was never, I think, terribly nurturing for females. How did you find it?
No.
You know what I mean?
It's a man's
yeah, right.
It's a man's world. You know, we could be production assistants.
Yes.
We could be associate producers. But it was rare, except at public television, to have female producers when I was coming up.
What kind of stuff did you start producing?
Well, when I finally did get to PBS after graduate school, I got a job at Impact, which at the time was pairing Jim Lawyer and Robin McNeil together for the first time.
Oh, how interesting.
In a documentary unit.
Yeah.
And I was a production assistant on one of the production teams, and we did a bunch of different shows that for about 6 months, and then the Watergate hearings started.
Wow.
And so I was retrained because they couldn't afford to get union people.
PBS, yeah.
As an AD in the studio, in the booth. What do they call it? The control room.
Sure.
Hello.
Sure, that's all right.
Control room. And I had three stopwatches in front of me, and they each timed different things. And so I had to get them all right. And that was just a fabulous experience to go from production to actually live TV, because we were playing the Watergate hearings at night. And there was commentary in between the breaks and things like that. So it was a really good education.
Bath by fire. Yeah, bath by fire.
Yeah, tell me about it. I almost got fired because I made one bad mistake.
Started screaming, Nixon's guilty, Nixon's guilty. Go ahead. on air, bursting in to say that guy's guilty.
I told you so. But no, I there was a minute of dead air on PBS because of me.
Well, that's okay.
And they didn't fire me. I'm really surprised.
So. What drew you away? What drew you? I know you came here to work for.
When I had finished, when TV was finished with me, when the news was finished with me, I got a job at Bursch & Marsteller in Chicago and moved here. And they wanted me because of my news experience. They wanted me to train executives on how to prepare and conduct themselves during print interviews and TV interviews.
So
that's what I did.
Wow.
And I did.
Was it?
I did that, and I produced, you know, meeting openers and
was that at all? Was that at all? Having known many, many, many executives who I wouldn't put on TV if they paid me, was that at all rewarding, or did you see the at the time, certainly at the time, and all the time, everybody wants to be on TV, and they want to be polished enough to be on TV. Many people will never be polished enough. Did you find that to be true?
Yes.
Yes.
Absolutely. I mean, you have to really know what you want to say, and of course, we would tell them that, and we would drum in their messages and things. We weren't quite as, wasn't quite as stark, I guess is the right word, as it is today, where people just ignore the questions and answer what they want to answer, even though you didn't ask that question. I mean, back then, 20, 25 years ago, people were still trying to answer questions.
Everybody wasn't, you know, hadn't watched Oprah for 15 years and thought they were great personalities. What drew you? We're going to have to take a break, but I want to know, it was around that time that you started to write fiction?
Not quite then. It was after I left and I went freelance doing the same thing that I had done at Bursch & Marsteller. That's when it became unsatisfying.
Gotcha.
Because I had been doing it for 25 years.
Wow.
And, I could do, it in my sleep, kind of. And I was looking for something new, and fiction writing became...
That's
what I wanted to do.
You found the right thing. When we get back from this short break, we will talk about.
Thank you.
Have you been on my? I've interviewed you a number of times on the show because I love your writing. What was your first? What is An Eye for Murder? Was that your first?
That was my first book. Right.
That was it, and it came out in 2001. Libby Fisher Hillman, I am not senile yet. 2001 and I for Murder, that was where I first met Libby. We'll continue this conversation in a couple minutes. Welcome back. I am talking to the astonishingly prolific and astonishingly talented Libby Fisher Hillman. Her latest book is titled Max's War. We will get to that specific book in a while, but I'm now exploring her career. We've got her first novel was An Eye for Murder. Let me ask you, what drew you to Chicago in the first place, other than a relatively decent job? And what I'm assuming that part of it is also what kept you here. This has been a very fertile territory for you as a writer, has it not?
Absolutely has. You know, my last years in broadcast news in D.C., I kept meeting all these people from Chicago who were now in D.C., and they kept saying, you know, you would love Chicago. It's a town you'd really like it. And I'm like, okay, right. I had spent some time in Chicago, and I had gone there, but, you know, it was just, to me, a gray industrial town.
Yeah.
And then I met a guy, and he asked me to come and visit, and I stayed for about a week or 10 days.
Mm-hmm.
I saw a different side of Chicago. Plus, I was older, and I really, really liked it. So when I went back to D.C., I was looking for anything that would bring me to Chicago, and then Bursch & Marsteller came through.
Oh, perfect.
So I moved.
Perfect.
What I loved about Chicago, and I still believe it's true, less so now than before, is that unlike L.A. or D.C., where you have to know somebody to get anything done or to get yourself, you know, I had this feeling that Chicago was wide open, and if you had a good idea and you were willing to work for it, you could make it in Chicago.
And
to some extent, that's still true.
Well, I think you'll agree with me that Chicago, in, maybe it's in all different professions, but I've always found in the arts, and I consider writing an art, that it is also among the most nurturing big cities in the world. That you and I both know a number of, Sean Turkover
Marcus Sakey
and Kevin Guilfoyle, and that it's a very nurturing. You must have found that very helpful when you began your writing career.
Absolutely. I mean, people like Sarah Paretsky Eleanor Taylor Bland. Well, Eleanor Taylor Bland and David Walker were in my writing group.
Oh, nice.
And they were the ones that really taught me the craft of fiction. My writing group was just fabulous. And then there's people like Alan Salter and Barbara D'Amato. I mean, everybody that I started out with was very helpful and generous with their time and helped me see where I was weak, helped, cheer me on when I was doing something right. And yes, you're right. It's an incredibly nurturing community, particularly the crime fiction community.
Yeah, exactly. What drew you to that? I mean, many people have been drawn to that because I think it's a very exciting.
Yeah. It's not, it's easy to plot. It's not easy to plot, but it's easier to plot because there's things happening. And I never really wanted to write a literary novel, although Max's War spills into them now.
Yeah.
And so did my prior one, A Bend in the River. But at the time, I just wanted to write entertaining stories that would keep people up way too late because they had to find out who did it.
That's right.
And at the time, I had been reading a lot of thrillers anyway. I mean, I read Forsythe, I read Ken Follett, I read, of course, now I'm having a brain freeze.
I don't know if you're going to say James Patterson, but, there's a...
No. I don't read James Patterson. Although I respect him.
He's
the one that taught me how to do short chapters.
And
it wasn't anything he said. I just read them, and I said, man, this is really a great way to rev up suspense. Shorter chapters, one scene per chapter.
In that whole, didn't you edit? You edited, and I think I may have reviewed
Chicago
it. Chicago Blues.
Yes. That's when you wrote the foreword for it.
Is that book still in print?
Yes, it is.
Chicago Blues is one of the. How did that come to be? You were the editor of it. You must have asked.
It was Ben LeRoy, who was the head of Bleak House at the time.
Right.
Poor Bleak House is gone, and he wanted to do an anthology about the blues. And I was really into the blues at that point. I said, "Oh, can I edit it?" And he said, "Of course. That's why I'm talking to you about it." So I wrote a story, and then I asked you to write the foreword, and I took stories, submissions from anybody that wanted to, enter a story. I didn't want to be, I'm only going to take this, and this.
Sure.
I mean, I asked the top writers, but I had lots of people submit stories and just chose the best stories, and they were just fabulous. That was like a little golden era.
It's not going to make Libby Fisher Hellman a lot of money in royalties, but if you can find that book, it's called Chicago Blues. It's a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful gathering of Chicago voices writing about blues. Blues being a very big umbrella. It's not just about some ancient blues singer, for instance. You also have written a number of. You're also a short story writer. And before we take another break, and then we'll talk all about Max's War. What's the difference for you between writing a short story and writing? Do you sit down and say, okay, I'm going to write a short story now, or do you start writing something and it begins to take the shape of a short story?
It's the scope of the content. It has to be smaller. It has to be more manageable. It can't be World War II.
Sure.
It might be a little episode on the night before Pearl Harbor or something like that. But, you have to really modify the content so that it's something manageable, that you can get good characterization and good plotting in 25 pages.
Have you ever started a short story that then turned into a novel? I'm ever curious about that. Have you?
Yes, I have. In fact, I have written short stories as a way to see if I could, if there was potential to stretch them into a novel. Mm. I'm going to be doing that right now. You know, my next work is going to be taking a short story and expanding it into a novel. I wrote the short story like 15 years ago.
Is one form easier than the other?
Well, I think short stories are easier because they're short.
Well, that's the obvious. Yeah, that's the obvious reason. Yeah. But
yeah,
I still think
every word in a short story is important, mm-hmm. and you really have to cut out anything that's superfluous.
Gotcha.
In a novel, you can sort of take your time. You can meander a little bit. Mm-hmm. You can take a time to really get into a character and what they're thinking and doing and why.
Sure. Let me ask you, and I do want to devote the last segment to Max's War, but you also, you're a podcaster now, aren't you?
I am, although that's dwindling. I'm not doing it as much as I used to. But yeah, for about 3 years, 4 years,
and
I was doing a lot of podcasting.
You interview authors?
Yep, mostly authors. Occasionally an expert. I had a cyber expert come on once. And I was really interested in that. I had an insurance person come on, and then a couple of detectives. So,
you can,
mostly authors.
You can, ladies and gentlemen. Libby has a wonderful, I think it's a great, great website. Very detailed. And it is.
Yeah,
no, it really is. It's LibbyHellmann. That's pretty easy, folks. Libby Hellmann.
.com. Like the mayonnaise.
.com, exactly. Like the mayonnaise.
Yeah.
We will take a break, get some news, and then we will come back and talk. Boy, the funny thing about this book, not the funny thing about this, very little that's funny in this book, but with it, one of the most interesting things about this book for me is as I'm reading it, a question keeps popping in my mind. And all of a sudden, I finish the book, I put it down. A couple days later, I pick up the acknowledgments and author's note, and it's virtually like I had asked you that question, and you were sitting there answering it. I'll read that answer after the news. Libby Fisher-Hellmann's latest book is fabulous. It's called Max's War. It is the story of a group of... describe who the Ritchie Boys were.
The Ritchie Boys are probably one of the least known stories.
Yeah.
In World War II,
mm-hmm.
they were a group of young men who either enlisted or were drafted into the Army because they were native-born to Germany and Austria, and there were even some Italians and Russians and Poles. And when the U.S. entered the war, they knew they were going to need native speakers when they interrogated POWs,
sure.
when they met up with enemies behind lines, and these folks could, they were from those countries originally, but they'd come to the U.S. after Hitler came to power. So these young men were trained in interrogation techniques, in counterintelligence, in field intelligence, and then sent back behind enemy lines.
And they were trained, they were called the Ritchie Boys because they were trained at a Camp Ritchie in Maryland.
Exactly. Yeah, they were not called Ritchie Boys until after the year 2000.
Wow.
Because the program was top secret and classified, and no one knew about it. Until it was declassified in 1998. And slowly the word started to creep out, and there have been a few books written about it, not many. Two nonfiction books.
It reminds me a bit of The Monuments Men, too, which is certainly a hidden story to me.
That whole thing.
And I eventually met the last living Monuments Man, an architect in Chicago named Dick Baranczyk.
It's so funny. I did an event today, and three people said their father or their uncle was a Ritchie Boy, but they just found out a few years ago.
Wow.
They weren't called Ritchie Boys until a documentary about them came out in about 2004. And then the name stuck, and that's how they allude to themselves.
It's just a...
go ahead. I didn't know if I was going to write this book because it seemed to me you know, I don't know that much about World War II. I'm very much interested in it, and I read a lot of fiction about it. But what could I do? What could I add? So I literally did 4 or 5 months of research before I even gave myself permission to write it.
Oh, good for you.
And after a while, certain patterns emerged, and I said, you know what? I think I might be able to do this.
Well, you write in the
and
back
so I started
in, the,
writing.
In the acknowledgments and notes, you write, this is the first novel I've written where 90% of the plot emerged organically from my research. And you also say that this is kind of a tribute to your late father-in-law. Who was active
yeah,
in the
OSS. Yeah, he was recruited by the OSS.
And
he was born in Regensburg. Funny about that. His family fled to Holland. And then after Hitler planned to invade Holland, they sent him to the U.S. I'm not sure how they got the visa, so I had to make that up. But they stayed. The parents stayed. The parents were taken away to a concentration camp. But Fred made it to the U.S., and he eventually was drafted. And after basic training, he was sent to Canada to train with the OSS.
Wow.
Now, what he did after he was trained was exactly what the Ritchie Boys did. So for a while, we wondered if he might have been a Ritchie Boy because there was a lot of free-flowing partnership between the Ritchie Boys and the OSS. They were all trained in interrogation. They were all trained in counterintelligence. They were trained in doing missions. And as you'll see in my book, or as people can read it, they'll see that Max, my protagonist, even though he's a Ritchie Boy, does do a number of OSS missions.
And it's also kind of a love story, too. But I want to, I mean, it's a wonderful, it's a really wonderful, exciting book with a driving narrative. You write, here's what I wanted to ask you is I'm reading the book, I'm going, wow, you know, World War II is the sort of topic that is inexhaustible. I wonder why that is. Here's what Libby Fisher-Hellman writes at the end in the acknowledgments and author's notes. Here you are, Libby, answering my question. I now understand why World War II is such an inexhaustible subject of literary fiction. It's impossible to cover its breadth and depth in one story or 1,000. I used to say that World War II was the last war where good and evil were so clearly defined. But now that I've finished Max's War, I realize that isn't much of an explanation. The fact is so many nations, so many events, so many people live through it, each with their own unique story, that it truly is a fool's errand to make any kind of generalization. You must be, Libby Fisher-Hellman, quite pleased by this book for a number of reasons, aren't you?
It was a departure for me, and I enjoyed writing it. I typically have mixed feelings about the writing process itself. I mean, part of me is the imposter syndrome. Oh, they're going to figure out I don't know what I'm talking about. They're going to see that I'm a fraud.
Uh-huh.
And the other part of me is, hey, that wasn't such a bad sentence. That wasn't such a bad paragraph. He's doing the right thing, you know? So I enjoy, enjoy torturing myself, I guess. This is the best way to say it, no.
Everybody, you should buy this book. It's a simple title to remember, Max's War. The nature of the book business, so the publishing end and the book promotion end and the public relations end has changed so dramatically in 20 years. You've rolled with those punches pretty well, haven't you?
I'm still here.
Yeah. Well,
I'm still writing, but again,
there's no book section in the Tribune. There's no real book section in the Sun-Times.
It's all changed.
Yeah,
it's all changed.
It's all changed.
You know, it's all online.
Yep.
It's all getting reviews. Happily, most of the traditional review sources still review me.
Yeah. Oh,
I mean, once in a great while, I'll get something from the Tribune.
Sure.
I have never been reviewed in the New York Times, but there's always next book. You know,
sure.
You never know.
Well, that's a.
I mean, PW and Book Reporter,
right?
And
Book List, and yeah,
Book List. You know, they still review me from time. You know, PW reviews me all the time, so I'm very happy that they do that.
That's great. What's your writing routine? Do you write every day?
I try to. I've had a death in my family, so I haven't been writing recently, but I'll probably get back to it fairly soon. I try to write at least a chapter a day.
Well, your new book sounds fascinating, too, but this book, this recently published, it's got, and this guy,
you know,
is this a real, is this a real man on the cover? Is this a real man, or does, is it?
No.
Oh.
The cover is AI.
Oh, is it really?
I thought,
wow, this guy should have a TV show or a movie or something.
Well, right. Everyone thinks he's gorgeous
yes.
and wonderful. And and he is Jewish, and I wanted him to look Aryan because I wanted him to be able to pass. And that was one of the reasons why the Army thought, okay, he speaks German and he's blonde. No cut, no. Anyway, we found him, and I said, that's the face I want. But he was wearing a jacket that was not even American. I don't even know what it was. So I had to hunt through Midjourney to find an American Army jacket, and I finally found one on a different man. But my designer was able to Photoshop the head of Max onto the jacket of the other man.
Fantastic.
So that was great. But then the other man was a colonel, we learned, because we were looking at all the stars and the insignias on his jacket. So we had to take everything off. Because I knew there would be somebody that knows all of this much better than I do.
Yeah,
they wouldn't
like the book because he's got the wrong button on his coat. Libby,
right,
congratulations.
Exactly. So we took everything off because and Max would have wanted that way because he wanted to be anonymous when he was, doing his mission.
He's quite a character.
Like
he's a read. Max Steiner.
Well, he's
wanted,
a hero. He's kind of a hero, but he is helpless through the first two-thirds of the book.
Yep.
And his helplessness is why the love affair happens and why the love affair ends and all of that, too.
It's got everything.
That was probably the part that made me the saddest.
Yeah.
But,
well,
anyway.
You know what? The part of it, the whole book, should make you very proud. Libby Fisher-Hellman, I'm so glad you found my email again. I'm so glad we can continue these conversations. Congratulations, and I can't wait for the next book.
Thanks, Rick.
You
bet. Thanks for having me.
Take care.